Abraham Lincoln entered the presidency with virtually no military experience beyond a brief stint fighting mosquitoes in the Black Hawk War. Yet over four brutal years, this self-educated lawyer transformed into one of history's most consequential military leaders. From the moment Confederate guns fired on Fort Sumter just weeks after his inauguration until his assassination days after Lee's surrender, Lincoln's entire presidency was defined by war. His evolution wasn't just remarkable, it was revolutionary. While managing generals with outsized egos and navigating treacherous political waters, Lincoln developed a comprehensive strategic vision that ultimately preserved the Union and ended slavery. His journey reveals not just how Lincoln won the Civil War, but how the war itself transformed Lincoln from a cautious politician into a bold wartime leader willing to use unprecedented executive powers to achieve victory. When Lincoln faced the Fort Sumter crisis in March 1861, he devised a brilliant strategic solution. Rather than reinforcing the fort with troops, which would appear aggressive, or abandoning it, which would demoralize Unionists, he announced he would merely send food to the starving garrison. This masterstroke forced the Confederates to either allow supplies and appear weak, or fire on an unarmed mission of humanity. When Confederate guns opened fire on April 12th, Northern opinion unified instantly behind Lincoln's call for 75,000 volunteers. Lincoln immediately asserted extraordinary executive authority, declaring a blockade and advancing treasury funds without congressional approval. When violence erupted in Baltimore and Maryland, officials cut telegraph lines and burned bridges to Washington. Lincoln suspended habeas corpus, a controversial move Chief Justice Taney ruled unconstitutional. Lincoln justified his actions with a medical metaphor. Often a limb must be amputated to save a life, but a life is never wisely given to save a limb. While securing border states like Maryland and Kentucky, Lincoln grew increasingly frustrated with General Scott's passive anaconda plan to slowly strangle the Confederacy. By summer, Lincoln had decided on a more aggressive approach, pushing for an attack on Confederate forces at Manassas Junction, despite earlier promises not to invade the South. The disastrous Union defeat at Bull Run in July 1861 forced Lincoln to rebuild his military strategy from scratch. He summoned George McClellan to command the Army of the Potomac, a decision with profound consequences. McClellan brilliantly organized and trained his forces, but consistently overestimated enemy strength and refused to attack. When he claimed Confederate forces numbered 170,000, actually around 40,000, Lincoln grew increasingly skeptical. By January 1862, Lincoln's frustration boiled over. He told advisers that if General McClellan did not want to use the army, he would like to borrow it. Lincoln replaced ineffective Secretary of War Cameron with the energetic Edwin Staunton and issued direct orders requiring all forces to move by February 22nd. McClellan finally proposed transporting his army down the Chesapeake to approach Richmond, a plan Lincoln reluctantly approved despite concerns about Washington's vulnerability. When Confederate forces withdrew from Manassas, journalists discovered their defenses included Quaker guns, painted logs, rather than real artillery, permanently damaging Lincoln's trust in McClellan's judgment. The relationship deteriorated further when McClellan ignored Lincoln's strategic advice during the Peninsula Campaign, culminating in the Seven Days battles where McClellan retreated despite numerical superiority, bitterly blaming Washington for sacrificing this army. The summer of 1862 marked a pivotal transformation in Lincoln's approach to the war. After McClellan's retreat from Richmond, Lincoln embraced a harder war policy, declaring the government couldn't play a game in which it stakes all and its enemies stake nothing. When border states rejected his proposal for compensated emancipation, Lincoln decided to issue an Emancipation Proclamation as a military necessity that would strike at the heart of the rebellion. Meanwhile, Lincoln placed his hopes in Henry Halleck as general-in-chief while dealing with McClellan's insubordination. When Lee invaded Maryland in September 1862, Lincoln reinstated McClellan despite cabinet opposition, a pragmatic decision recognizing McClellan's organizational talents and popularity with troops. At Antietam, McClellan achieved a limited victory but failed to destroy Lee's army when he refused to commit his reserves. Nevertheless, Antietam provided Lincoln the victory he needed to issue his preliminary Emancipation Proclamation on September 22nd, transforming the war's purpose from merely restoring the Union to creating a new birth of freedom. When McClellan again failed to pursue Lee's retreating army, Lincoln's patience finally snapped. "I have tried long enough to bore with an auger too dull to take hold," he explained, removing McClellan from command on November 7. Lincoln's search for an effective commander continued through a series of disappointments. Burnside's disastrous frontal assaults at Fredericksburg in December 1862 resulted in catastrophic casualties. When Lincoln appointed Fighting Joe Hooker in January 1863, he wrote an extraordinary letter acknowledging Hooker's ambition while warning against rashness and the dangers of undermining command authority. Despite initial administrative improvements, Hooker surrendered the initiative to Lee at Chancellorsville, resulting in another devastating defeat. When news reached Lincoln, witnesses described him as ashen and overwhelmed, pacing and repeating, my God, what will the country say?" Throughout these dark periods, Lincoln maintained unwavering support for Ulysses S. Grant in the Western Theater. When politicians demanded Grant's dismissal after heavy casualties at Shiloh, Lincoln reportedly replied, "I can't spare this man. He fights." Grant's innovative Vicksburg campaign, cutting loose from supply lines and living off the land while winning five consecutive battles, delighted Lincoln with its speed and simplicity. When Hooker proposed attacking Richmond instead of pursuing Lee's army moving north in June 1863, Lincoln exasperatedly responded, "Lee's army and not Richmond is your true objective point." After Hooker's resignation, Lincoln appointed George Meade just days before the Battle of Gettysburg. The summer of 1864 marked the war's darkest hour for Lincoln. Despite Grant's pressure on Lee and Sherman's advance toward Atlanta, mounting casualties without decisive victories demoralized Northern voters. Democratic newspapers denounced the war, while Lincoln's own party leaders believed his re-election impossible. Lincoln faced intense pressure to abandon emancipation for peace. At an August meeting with his frightened National Executive Committee, he refused to compromise on either union or freedom, even at the likely cost of electoral defeat. The turning point came with Sherman's telegram, "Atlanta is ours and fairly won," electrifying the North. Sheridan's victories in the Shenandoah Valley followed, virtually ensuring Lincoln's re-election. Sherman's march to the sea and Thomas's destruction of Hood's army at Nashville delivered the final military blows to Confederate hopes. Throughout the war's final months, Lincoln remained firm. Restoration of national authority, no compromise on slavery's abolition, and no armistice short of complete Confederate surrender. When meeting Confederate peace commissioners in February 1865, he insisted on these principles despite enormous pressure. Lincoln's evolution as commander-in-chief paralleled the war's transformation from limited conflict to revolutionary struggle. His strategic vision, focusing on destroying enemy armies rather than capturing territory, coordinating multiple theaters, and recognizing war's political dimensions, proved decisive. His moral clarity and unwavering determination during the darkest moments ensured that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.